So this is the Dulai Newsletter for January 1969, Volume 1, Number 7. And it says Part 1 of 2, Part 2 next month. So it begins with these big headlines. It's quite a big format. It says the meanings behind these headlines. And the headlines are Teachers Strike, Schools Close. Another one, Apollo 8 Triumphs. Another one, Negro Students Battle Police. The fourth one, Tear Gas Used in Chicago Riots. Then a subheading, Violence Erupts in Chicago, Minority Groups Rebel. Then below that, below that article, it says, Court OKs Nudity. See Private Parts, page 4. So we will start to read what the first page says. Physically, the young seem to feel, and that's in italics, physically, the young seem to feel that the planet has become their stage. Now, this is in analyzing the summer of 68, when you had the end of the Prague Spring, the Democratic Convention, riots there, assassination of Martin Luther King in April and Robert Kennedy in June, quite a tumultuous year, and it was the first year for live satellite broadcasts for the news stations. So it's a major transition. It's a year after Rai has returned to the plane of essence, if you use cosmic awareness's marker points. So here's McLuhan weighing in. Physically, the young seem to feel that the planet has become their stage. They want to act outside, in the street, on the campus. Oh, yeah, there was all the student riots in Columbia and all that in the spring. They have shifted their dramatic quest for new identities away from the expression of private opinions to the enactment of a new kind of group theater. Now, this was the heyday of the hippie culture, performance groups, all kinds of things were going on. Also, the feminist meme is starting out of New York City. The new program they offer for scrutiny and the new program the kids offer for scrutiny and participation seems to many people to be trash, such as has never been seen before. Hyphen. A wild orgy of law and ordure. Ordure is garbage. So not law and order, but ordure. A wild orgy of law and ordure. Rich material for the hypothetical... Rich material for the hypothetical probe that the satellite environment offers the planet itself as a new kind of theatrical stage is to be found in the Walker Report to the National Commission of the Causes and Prevention of Violence, subtitled Rights in Conflict, the Violent Confrontation of Demonstrators and Police in the Parks and Streets of Chicago during the week of the Democratic National Convention, published by Bantam Books, December 1968. So here's this new report, just came out, and McLuhan's analyzing it immediately. Under a section entitled, quote, The Festival of Life, the report explicitly acknowledges the new orgy or carnival-like developments that baffle political and educational establishments in Tokyo as much as in Berlin or Paris or New York. Then it quotes the report. While plans were being made by anti-war and other dissident groups for activities in Chicago during convention week, preparations were underway within the hippie communities in New York, Chicago, on the West Coast, and elsewhere for a massive convocation. The vision was one of a carnival-like party in one of Chicago's lakefront parks, a festive counter-convention offering entertainment, discussion forums, information exchanges, workshops in problems facing dissenting youth, and other attractions of interest to the nation's subculture dropouts. The festival was seen as continuing day and night. Now I have to go turn the pages and find where this continues. Just a second here. Where was it? Violence in Chicago. Okay, I think that's it. The festival was seen as continuing day and night throughout convention week, and the prospect excited hippies across the country. Now, remember, this is the convention that leads to the trial of the Chicago 8, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Rennie Davis, David Dillinger, Bobby Seale of the Black Panthers, and a couple other people. So they're all going to be on trial within a year. But they're running amok. And a good movie to see the actual footage of this is called Medium Cool. Medium Cool, made by Haskell Wexler, I think. Great movie in 68. It takes place in Chicago during this week of demonstrations, and of course, the character walking through the riots, it gets way out of hand beyond what the movie producers thought was going to happen. So it's a live docudrama kind of thing, accidentally. Unless they were CIA and knew there would be CIA agent provocateurs and were all ready to capitalize on it. Haskell Wexler is a famous Hollywood cinematographer at that time. Okay. So it says, for those who were already coming, the festival was an added attraction. For others, it was to be a demonstration itself, the demonstration of an alternative lifestyle, the surfacing of an underground culture, a renaissance of youth, as they called it. And then they quote the report saying, long-haired political activists who had participated in the Pentagon March on October 21, 1967, viewed that demonstration as a turning point. Quote, a new kind of experience in which creativity was unleashed, unquote. Then it quotes Abby Hoffman. People are devising their own schemes, Abby Hoffman, one of the flamboyant spokesmen for the underground movement, recalls. Then the report says, continues to quote Abby Hoffman, I think. No, this is the report. Hippie types had joined the more formalized protest groups and had added a new dimension which they considered to be satirical. Their statements, while objectionable to many, made good newspaper print. Then Abby Hoffman says, we saw a chance of developing a real populist involvement among the people within the revolution. Revolution for the hell of it. Theater in the streets, says Abby Hoffman. Then the report says, this theatrical concept was a primary ingredient of their approach. The audience would be the American public. The means of communication would be the mass media, manipulated to create distorted images of themselves. The stage would be the streets, and the message would be a demonstration of disrespect, irreverence, and ridicule. It is an approach most graphically described in Abby Hoffman's words, quote, you got a TV set? That's a jungle. You think that gives you shit about words, lineal concepts? We get on that tube. We get information out, and our information is heavy, and it sticks, and it's exciting. It's alive. As quoted from the New York Free Press, October 3rd to the 9th, 1968. Now, while this was going on, Carol and I were in Montreal. Quote, these active hippies, many of them with backgrounds in the creative arts, journalism, and the theater, meant to put creativity into protest demonstrations with an emphasis on individual participation. The report quotes Abby Hoffman again. Hoffman describes how, quote, people will be attempting to use guerrilla theater techniques. People will be attempting to use satire. People will be attempting to talk to other people, and people will be passing out newspapers, and some will be stoned, and some will be fucking on the grass, and people will do whatever they want to do. There's no reason why people come to demonstrations, no single cause. It's multifaceted, and it's generally a feeling of disgust with what's going on in this country in every area conceivable that's controlled by the power. I use guerrilla theater as a medium for creating what I call blank space. Remember we played Taylor Swift's song, Blank Space, today, requested by Ion. He must have seen this coming. Blank space is where you use media so that the observer, the audience, becomes participant, becomes involved. End of quote. That's pages 41 to 42 in the report. Then McLuhan writes, what Hoffman refers to as blank space, blank quotes, is a specific form of tactile space which is literally interval, literally in italics. The space of the interval, says McLuhan, is that of resonance and involvement, which our physicists have long considered as the basis of quantum mechanics. It is now possible to see why the new guerrilla theater relates to the new satellite environment as well as to the new physics. Okay. And we've now...
All participants are now unmuted.
For commentary. You're all unmuted. What do you think? Wasn't that neat? Pretty good description. Sounds like Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
I was there, Bob. I was in it. I was in the demonstration. We shut down our campus administration building. I wore an American flag as a shirt. Got arrested, put in jail for dishonoring the flag, stuff like that. So, I was right there.
What city were you in?
I was in a college campus in Western Kentucky called Western Kentucky University.
And so, what year? Do you know that was that summer, that year, 68?
Yeah, I just started college. I started in the fall of 68. So the summer, I have no idea. You know, I remember watching the convention, the Democratic convention, and all the, you know, the cops coming out and beating everybody up. And then, of course, the music, what was really unique is that all the musicians were collaborating to get that same revolutionary message out. Crosby, Stills, Nash,
right.
Young, they were really...
So you were 18. You were 18, just out of high school, watching this. Now, you said you got arrested. That's later?
Yes. I got arrested in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in spring break. Walking down the beach with my girlfriend took a real American flag and made a shirt out of it. And I was walking down the beach with that on, and the cops picked me up and threw me in jail. And then they really couldn't.
For how long?
Just 8 hours, 16 hours. They couldn't figure out anything actually to really charge me with. And they were just harassing me. They just didn't like, you know,
okay,
that somebody would wear that, you know, make a shirt out of a flag.
But your girlfriend was wearing it, not you.
No, she was a seamstress. She was there for
fashion. Oh, she made it for you?
She made it for me, and then it was I think she actually said she stole it from the university. So I don't know.
Right.
I don't know if that's true or not, but, I mean, it was a beautiful shirt. I mean, it was just beautiful.
Okay, Kyle. Now, that's your experience, your sensory experience. Now, McLuhan says sensory experience is not adequate for understanding the present. And he said that sensory experience is not input. So you're giving your daily experience of that year. Now, you did not think that what you were doing was expressing a resonance with quantum physics and the satellite environment. That you did not know, correct?
No. I didn't understand.
Now, this is where...
I didn't understand anything other than I didn't... My father and uncles were all in World War II. They were all pro-military, they were, you know, it was like, why don't you go join the Marines and go to Vietnam? I'm like, and why would I want to do that? I was like, you know, so I rebelled more against them than the system. It was just right there in my own.
Right. But here's the thing. If I was there with you, I would say, hey, Kyle, come over here. Tell your father that I ain't engaging in a small military theatrical operation in Vietnam. I'm going to participate in the global theater. I'm going to get on the news with Abby Hoffman. That's the real front. And I would have told you all about the global theater caused by satellites. And you say, you fucking nut, you speed freak, you get out of my life, Bob. And
no,
that's
no,
what it would have happened.
No, I probably would relate to you better then than I do now.
I wouldn't let you relate to me. I would have been telling you, do your homework. You get home, you don't go to school, you start reading, understanding media, blah, blah, blah. I would have given you your course curriculum, which, of course, you wouldn't have done. But I would have said that. But here's the point here. McLuhan is taking these events and relating it to invisible forces in the environment. This is what's unique. And people read this. They didn't know what he meant. How could my kid, who's fucking up his college life by getting these girls pregnant and smoking dope and going to protests, how's that relate to the new quantum physics again, Mr. McLuhan? And how's that relate to the satellite environment? See? You might as well just say it's ionic. This is like what people think. Oh, we're talking about ion did this, did that. Same incomprehensibility here.
And I'm sure that I can say that was a time that was right for ion then. If he had stepped in there and
Ion was there through me. I did it, didn't get anywhere. We were ahead of our time. Okay, well, so I was there. But I'm not going to get into an argument with you. I'm interested in other people's opinions here.
Okay,
I appreciate your input. Stay around. We'll come back to you. Come back to you. Okay. Okay.
Would you say the blank space is the interval?
Yes.
I mean, for example, I have to think in music, the interval is the difference between two frequencies, two notes. But there is actually no blank space between these two defined notes. There's other pitches, other frequencies.
No, that's true. Now, what he means by blank space, and he has a square here, an empty square. He's talking about visually. Because tactility is not any particular sense, it doesn't have any sensory data in it. It's this weird interplay of the sensory data. It's in the gap, in the interval. Then visually, if you were going to draw it, you either make a black square or an empty square because it has no visual content. The musical part of, as you're defining, I've never seen McLuhan address that.
Yes, but even in the visual, the emptiness, the whiteness, or the light.
Yeah.
I mean, there is nothing which is empty. There is no silence, and there is always a frequency of light or sound.
All right. Now that's, remember what McLuhan says when he gets the whole world watching in Annie Hall. You think my whole fallacy is wrong. Any definitions that McLuhan was stating would be wrong if you analyze it in detail. But he wasn't providing that kind of literate accuracy. He was providing a myth, an encapsulation of people's experience. And, of course, it was a fallacy, but it was a fallacy with the most appropriate pitch. So you don't want to get bogged down. You have to understand why one would start quibbling with McLuhan, which many people did, and say, no, that's not true, this is not true. They missed what needed to be required, needed to be communicated. We're in a virtual society by that time, and the facts did not rule anymore.
Well,
so the government presented
also
its myth. Go ahead.
Yeah, he said he was trying to express the new occult and these invisible forces and how they were affecting society and people and the environment.
And you wouldn't use literate facts. You'd get as many approximate statements, but even as Herbert Krugman at General Electric proved McLuhan with his technology in 1970. He proved that the brain did go through a certain kind of reaction watching TV as opposed to reading a newspaper. When McLuhan was told that this guy who set out to disprove McLuhan on a scientific efficient causality basis was surprised to find out that McLuhan was right, that the brain was changed under different media, McLuhan said, well, that's fine and dandy, but I'm interested in making more discoveries. He didn't even care that they proved it, because proving wasn't the issue. It was the fact that society was being grown into a new frequency, like what Ion says, a new matter, and being torn apart, and Armageddon was upon everybody, and he was interested in offering patterns to give people poise. And you couldn't, no other teacher did that. They were trying to present facts and arguments in their classes, which just led the kids to dropping out, because McLuhan provided a cool image. All the professors and other actors provided a hot image where they were the authority and you couldn't engage. McLuhan allowed others to engage in his image, in his information.
Yes,
Abby Hoffman almost didn't do it. What?
He had not the right context or words to express what he was trying to translate, but maybe you can. And that's how
You can't comment on things verbally. That's why if you utter something, it is immediately a fallacy. And that's what he said. You think my whole fallacy is wrong. There were parts of McLuhan's fallacy that were more correct than anybody else because it was a matter of ratios. And what he was saying got to the problem better than other minds. So, yes, it was a fallacy, but it was not completely wrong. You know, McLuhan used to quote somebody, I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. You heard Mary quote that last week. One thing about Mary McLuhan, she has a lot of her father's aphorisms ready to be thrown at you.
Hey, Bob,
there is a McLuhan aphorism for every occasion.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Bert.
Bob, you when that last part you read, you said blank space, tactile space, the interval. But then there was something you said afterwards. Was that part of the text or was that your commentary?
No, that's part of the text. It says here, you know, Abby Hoffman is saying blank space is where you use media so that the observer, the audience, becomes participant, becomes involved. So here's Abby Hoffman instinctively knowing that you want to get the audience involved, so you don't offer complete statements. You kind of hint or wink, or he used to write the word fuck on his forehead, you know, and then it would be photographed. So he created an evolving space he called blank space. So McLuhan is saying what Hoffman refers to as, quote, blank, unquote, space is a specific form of tactile space which is literally interval. The space of the interval is that of resonance and involvement. Now, the resonance part would be your pitches, Roxana, resonating pitches. The space of the interval is that of resonance and involvement, which our physicists have long considered as the basis of quantum mechanics. It is now possible to see why the new guerrilla theater relates to the new satellite environment as well as the new physics. Before these events in Chicago, you didn't have any relative data to kind of explain why those events were part of tactile space. He says it's now possible. He's not saying this view is correct. He's saying, yes, this view is correct, but here's the important thing. Right now, in 1968, it's now possible to see why I'm correct, is what McLuhan's saying, when I say the new guerrilla theater relates to the new satellite environment as well as to the new physics.
And now, it has to do also with the obsolescence of time and space as we thought before when the quantum physics arrived?
Right.
Blank space.
You know, Einstein obliterated Newton's absolute, it's called absolute space, absolute time. That's what Einstein made it relative. It wasn't absolute. It wasn't locked in visual space. So the electric environment, you know, 100 years ago, gave new ideas to people like Einstein. They started saying, well, no, there's more than just rigid visuality. There's other things going on. And then he always kept putting it back into visual space, like talking about light bending and things like that. But he was trying to describe the new space-time continuum, which was not as precise or actually visible as what people thought. And then quantum mechanics went further than Einstein, you know, 20 years later in the 20s. They were responding to the new media environments. I mean, Einstein is in what you got, a crummy telephone, you got a crummy car, and crummy lighting, all that shit. 20 years later, you got radio, mass consumption of automobiles, telephone, you know, the whole media thing is quite different 20 years later, so physics had to conceptualize and update itself, upgrade itself. It didn't know that it was responding to radio and television environments. It just felt it instinctively.
Mm.
And then you look at what they describe, you know, particles are in two places at the same time. That's what happens when you're on the telephone. They were actually describing people, which brings it back to why Ion says chemistry is people. People are chemistry. That's what McLuhan's saying. Our ideas come out of our media, our technologies. And so we are technologies. So people are involved in the making of matter. That just occurred to me as we were talking. Isn't that neat? Yeah,
so
very neat.
Yeah, well, we create matter, right? So that's how we're involved in it.
Yeah. And we create nothing, but our society and the social order says, no, you made something. And they define what it is, the medium that the society uses, from the canoe to you know, a pen to drums to radio. They determine the ideas that people think matter is made up of. But I would say people don't create anything. They remember what was created. That's a fine, putting a fine point to it. We don't have to go that extreme, but The technologies, we create the technologies. What?
They remember and then they believe, and the belief was a thought you had a long time.
No, they don't believe. They remembering is Einstein mode, is that you wouldn't believe. You remember how it was created without you by something else. Now, if you believe you're a sovereign king, okay, everything in the world was created by you, because in the end, only you exist. So you track yourself back thousands of years. Oh, yeah, I'm the guy who created this, and your neighbor could say the same thing.
And I was thinking, for example, that the Finnegan's Wake, the Finnegan's Wake starts and ends the same way. So maybe this interval is not emptiness, but full of content.
It is, yes, full of resonance. Somebody wrote that. Somebody the other day said, they wrote to me, and, oh yeah, it was Matt, who was on here from China earlier and didn't say anything. He said, I read what he sent last week. He said he realized that Finney's Wake was one big interval. That's how he made sense out of the book. But yeah, definitely it's a resonant interval. McLuhan used to say it's a noun and a verb without a predicate. It doesn't land. The sentence doesn't land anywhere. There's a lot of actions, but it doesn't land at a predicate position, you know, the object of the sentence. It makes every object part of it. But that's, it was fun reading this stuff in the late 60s. You know, you'd see all these events, everybody's running around voting in Nixon. Remember, this protest and that stuff made America finally give up its liberalism. So we've had enough of this chaos. We're going to put the fascist Nixon in. And it was really interesting, knowing all that was going on around, then to read this very unique, different point of view. Very fucking different, you know? It was exciting.
And is it that the reason why you say the interval is tactile? Because it cannot be blank space. It's always full of...
It can't be anything particular. It's all and nothing, you know. It's the interval, the content could be pitches and proprioception, the non-visual senses, but tactility itself. And McLuhan used to call it the interval tactile. It was not any particular position. It was not any sensory data. It was the sculpting of them. So what does the sculpting? That gets into the ionosphere. The ion, I think you could say, sculpts matter. And ion manipulates the ions. It manipulates the electron, neutron, proton. So this sculpting that is done by something in our human experience is the role of tactility. And tactility, the concept, expresses the thing that's sculpting our sensory data into coherence, which is not supported by anybody in science. Maybe there are scientists who, if you knew McLuhan, oh, that guy is proving McLuhan. And the scientists might not even know about McLuhan. But, you know, many people, and McLuhan scholars have said, McLuhan blew it by bringing in this absurd idea of tactility. He should have dropped it. That's what Andrew Crystal said to me back in 2007. But I think it's a really good concept, idea, and it covers a lot of the art movements, what artists were trying to say in their theories over the last 130 years.
Yes, because the evolution of art is actually, well, the evolution of everything is actually the evolution of perception.
Yes, and the new perception, you can track through all the revolutions and manifestos of perception, advocacy of this and that, they all in the end were saying, hey, we're not visual anymore. We're maybe acoustic, but there's some other factor going on. I mean, the cyberneticists called it information. Information runs matter. But they all were saying there's a non-visual factor that's molding our perception. And then you look at every movement was trying to express that in some way. I mean, look at Barnett Newman. He painted, you know, stripes. That guy, Ed somebody, forget his last name, he painted in a dark room canvas with black. So he painted black in a black environment. And then he, you know, produced canvases of black. Ed Reinhardt, I think his name was. And he had a flash in the pan. He was popular for a while. But he was trying to make non-visual art, right? And really didn't want to be influenced by anything. Okay, I'm going to go into a dark room, black room, and paint black on my canvas. So it was the idea of the action, not to be have any visual content. That was the meaning of his painting. So the crude bourgeois viewer would say, oh, look at that idiot. I mean, my five-year-old kid could paint a black canvas. Well, no, but the kid wouldn't know to do it in a black room and make a theatrical statement out of it, out of the action. Isn't that profound?
Yes.
The painting of the stripes. Are you talking about that painting that sold for $1 million?
There are many of these paintings. Yeah, Barney Newman. All those guys. Their paintings sell for a lot. Yeah, Barnett Newman made stripes. Ed Reinhardt
actually
just painted black on black.
You know, the painting going out of the canvas of them, it's invading the whole environment. It's like the artist is being aware of art being obsolete and the environment becoming the art, the form.
Right. They're trying to express that in the painterly medium. Now, you said, did you name a Barnett Newman thing in particular? What were you just saying?
No, you gave the example of the painter painting everything outside the canvas in black.
And the canvas itself in black, yeah.
Yes,
they were,
color is going out of the canvas, it's the environment is becoming the art, the concept.
Right. He went up Jackson Pollock. Pollock was stupid. He included color in his canvas. He made a mistake.
He was more into the action painting, into the gesture of painting. It was not actually.
Yes.
It was the process
of Ed Reinhardt.
Kinematics, you say, the movement.
Yeah, kinematics, yeah.
Ed Reinhardt made a mistake.
Yeah, the movement was important. Kinetic space is the reaction to tactility. So Ed Reinhardt, he made a mistake. He forgot to illustrate the kinematics of himself, and he just went into a hyper-visual mode of canceling out visual space via visual means.
But it's a perfect explanation of modern art, because they're trying to translate with the abstraction, that the environment is the art form.
Yeah, and it's hard to see the environment. It's not what you think it is. It's a surround, multi-sensory surround. Yeah, and they're trying. And McLuhan used to say this. He said all the artists and all the arts and all the different entertainment media were all saying the same effect. He was the only one who noticed that what they were expressing, what the hidden ground was. And then he said, this is altering society beyond anything that any artist made.
Yes, and that's why they start doing these ready-made. Like, they just take the object and that's the art. There is no more point in building something when everything is art.
Everything's being made for you. The environment is given.
If painting is obsolete, where is painting 50 years from now?
More and more obsolete. In other words, more and more people doing it. Remember,
it's only a decoration.
Right. And obsolescence means more and more people will be doing it, but it does not affect society. In McLuhan's term was constitutive. It didn't make a constitutive influence. Now, what influenced us today is, you know, whatever new computer thing comes out next week. That's what alters society, and that's on the technological level. Painting, and more people will do stuff that's harmless. It doesn't upset the apple cart, and that would be painting. Or they'll be doing, somebody might be doing the painting, but maybe more and more people will be doing digital things. But there will always be someone, just to be different.
Because just like in music, composers don't limit themselves to be only composers, they're sound artists. in the visual arts, artists are working with light, for example, or hologram.
Neon light. Yeah, Diane Flavin, 50 years
projection.
Ago, he started out of neon light.
Yes, the visual,
to do something
what's
unique.
The point of painting something?
Yeah. But the point is that you can get a banker to buy it. And a lot of people in New York City, more art than ever. They're not all selling, but you can jump into the lottery and you might make a lot of money from your useless paintings. Because some banker's got a, or some guy making a lot of money in Wall Street has to have a tax write-off, right? And
well, I think it's a way to translate their capital into something which is not money, which may have no value, like the euros.
Right. And they will...
The elite take great prize.
Beg your pardon?
I said there's people who take great pride in purchasing those really expensive paintings.
That's right. Usually there are guys in the business world who haven't got a sophisticated training in the arts. They don't know the history. They just think they have a vague notion because they're not inclined that way. They don't know much about the world. They say, well, it'd be cool if I had some neat painting to put in my home. I'll be able to get laid more. You know, they have normal
reasons. I can talk about it
reasons.
To my friends.
Right, something to talk about. So that's decoration.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've got the intellectual tradition of in art form and art in America, you know, people reviewing these paintings, making a big deal out of it. I just bought a book by Jerry Saltz, who was the art critic for the Village Voice, and it has a collection of a lot of his reviews of the art scene in New York. And I like reading that kind of stuff. Just it's like anthropology, you know, reading about this artist and what they say about him, what Jerry Saltz says. Jerry Saltz, I remember in 2005, he got fed up. He said there was just too much art going on for him to even have a meaning for why review it. He knew his point of view was irrelevant, or it wasn't constitutive. He wasn't influencing anybody.
Just as you study media, it's interesting to study art to see how the perception evolved.
Well, art is media. I include that. And, you know, and I read books and like this thing. I'm looking forward to reading all the art that I didn't know about that happened in New York while I was there because there was so much going on. I didn't keep track of all of it. And I'll read Jerry's reviews of it.
Bob, it's like we're trying to define that interval that can't be defined. In physical.
Well, pick the medium you're talking about. It's like we're trying to speak or write.
All
and
of it.
Pick the
yeah.
medium.
We're talking
not all
about
of it,
art now.
Because, yeah, but there's a lot of people taping art. So we may be, now we're not trying to define it. We're not trying to write about it. We're just recording it on our TV cameras.
Well, maybe I need to qualify we then.
You do. You have to use the medium of the particular moment.
Anyone just recording. Anyone who's trying to put words or visual, like paint or whatever an artist uses, to express or pinpoint this interval does not, it cannot be pinpointed. It cannot be defined because it's timeless. But little men or as humans, we just continue to swim in it or something, like, because now you've added yet another thing. If we're not expressing and trying to come up with a way to express it, we're recording what other people have tried to express about it.
Well, I think it has to do with this, with the awe, the Rai effect of the artist creating something, an object that will create admiration and surprise and awe in others. It's like he has a special power of a god of creating. It's the Rai effect you talk.
Yeah, why do we
hey, the Rai. Hey, Gene, you got to talk louder. Fix your phone. You're very faint.
All right. I have a whole new setup. Is this better?
A little better, yeah. But it could be better.
It might be as good as it's going to get. Okay, let's see how this goes, Bob, because I'm recalling your diary reference to your father when your father was so excited that Finnegan's Wake was going to be released. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
And I'm thinking about, I'm imagining McLuhan's concepts and ideas are so very different from our conventional training. But McLuhan picked up something from Finnegan's Wake and something from all of the information about science, about quantum physics and all the stuff, and put it together in a way that he had no doubt. He had no idea what he was talking about, but he had no doubt, and then just spent his life trying to get other people to get just a clue of what he was conceiving. And you were one of those people that stuck with it or stayed on it to try to get it. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, that's
and
true.
So now, two years into this, yes, I imagine. Yeah, have you ever thought about how did McLuhan put all this together? Or you watched him for many years. Was it after he was really, I can't even use the words. You know, he really had this idea and was driven to continue to write about it and get people to understand it like he was? Or was it?
Yeah, he was a genius. He writes in his diary at 19 years old. He says, there's something about advertising. I'm going to figure out the new laws that advertising expresses. He said that 19 years old. He got this notion of something new, a new kind of thinking or a new kind of sociology, and then he just pursued it. And one thing led him to the next. He was luckily assisted all along the way by either his own non-physical or something.
Yes, I accept he also was a parallel world.
Right. First time he did it was out in Vancouver. He was in Winnipeg. Must have gone on vacation out there. But he's he was 19 in 1930. So he started this in 1930. And he gets his PhD, 13 years later, and that was about the medium is the message in the history of Western scholarship. I mean, he caught on to it pretty early, and then he just kept filling it out.
That was advertising in print and on the radio at that time.
Yes, magazines. He said, advertising is rhetoric. Rhetoric, which was obsolesced sidestepped by dialectic for 200 or 300 years, that's science and logic. Rhetoric had to come back. A rhetorical understanding had to be brought back as a key form of knowledge because people were being persuaded by an advertising of by an environment of advertising and rhetoric.
And when he says this phrase, "Today man has no physical body," he's translated into information or an image. There are no connections in resonant space. I don't really understand what he says. There is no connection in resonant space when there is no physical body.
It's visual space. You know, in chemistry, they show you the little bars that attach the hydrogen to the oxygen to the carbon. You know, those little lines. As early as 1939, Linus Pauling, who won, I think, the Nobel Prize twice, he, in his book, The Chemical Bond, explained, based on quantum physics, chemistry, whatever obscure research that scientists were doing, he said there is no connections in matter. And McLuhan always quoted him. But your average citizen didn't know that. Visually biased citizen thought everything was connected because they've been trained by books. But there's no connections in electricity. There's juxtapositions of environments, but there's no visual anchoring. Anchoring, ropes that tie matter down. And that is actually what happened when you brought in radio. The resonance of radio obsolesced the linear connecting thinking that a book created. So first of all, it was in the environment, and then men's and women's concepts about science, physics, and art changed because the media changed them. And nobody knew that point till McLuhan, with Lewis beginning to intuit it first.
Yeah, if McLuhan had an image head, it would be this just continual extension.
It's a resonating interplay. When he used to always say, if you press your hand on the table, that's kinetic pressure, that's not tactility. It's when you lift your hand off the table and then retouch it, that's beat, that's interval, that's rhythm. That's the way our sensory life is. There's no connection, you know, where my hand touches the table and it's stuck to the table. Luckily,
right.
It doesn't stick.
Right. And if you picture the cellular level, the cell or the atom, those...
Right.
The atoms do not really touch. They vibrate and attract and get really, really close, but they don't...
They sing to each other. You get into the tonalities. And, you know, they seem to. And there was another point there. Oh, yeah, as you listen to Ion, he's saying tonalities are underneath the atoms. Ion is often trying to explain tactility. He doesn't use that term, but then eventually he agreed with me and used it. But he's always describing a tactile process, if you listen to him closely. Just by saying, okay, is this a fact? Sometimes. To say sometimes means there's ratios and figure ground relationships. That's a changeable relative situation. That involves tactility, a shifting factor.
So Ion is off. Would you say it's that there really is no interval for Ion because it is continuous?
It's not empty. It's not a blank space. It's full of information and frequency.
And they call it dark matter. Bob Marshall, in his early session with Ion, he asked if there was tactility in non-physical, you know, in the guff, and Ion said no. So tactility is still within the world of matter, and Ion is not matter. But Ion has to discuss concepts and social phenomenon, and in the end, he's got the best view because he's including tactility. He can see it in social mortar.
See, and it's like layers to really, what's the word? Feel, understand, grok.
Overlay. Overlay was the word.
Overlay tactility. It's kind of sunk in deeper now with this conversation, Bob. That's very
good.
You got to keep going. You just have to keep going.
You have to just keep hanging in here, participate, and then you'll get it. And then you'll get the next thing. Then you'll get why you didn't get it. Then you'll not get it. Then you'll get a new one. Get along.
And it's the same with physical existence in a way. When you were reading the Dewline or McLuhan, I was thinking, when you were reading about the 60s or his observations of the that nothing really has changed. And I, my whole life, have remarked at, you know, the difference in the decades and how much of a difference there is. And as I was listening to this, nothing's really changed.
Well, here's the way you say it. Much changed when electric media came in, but for 100 years we've been in the tactile space of the electric extension. So on the broad level of what the electric environment is, it's a tactile situation. That hasn't changed because we're still in electricity. That's the main medium.
Swimming is the word I want to use.
What'd you say?
Swimming. We're swimming in the...
Yeah, treading water, surfing.
And so I'm trying to translate the pattern that you just made me think of. When you said we were in the tactile space of the electric environment, then we're moving to the autonomic
right.
interval. This interval, it's like the frequency that is beyond everything. And it's autonomic,
yeah,
it's no more.
It's already happened. The neutron. But the this is the question for me is that Ion keeps pointing to newer technologies that'll obsolesce the our computer structure now. It may obsolesce regular electric lighting. That's what's interesting is how much will the new technology be totally unlike our electric media? That's not clear to me how different it's going to be.
Well, if what you
well,
said
isn't that Coldplay? Coldplay will
yeah,
electric
yeah.
environment.
No, Coldplay creates endless electricity. So, no, it's part of the electric environment, or at least it produces infinite amounts of electricity. That's the frictionless level of it.
But it will obsolesce the way that electricity
yeah.
is delivered.
Yeah, you won't require to pay for it anymore. So we just read the first article, Violence Erupts in Chicago, Minority Groups Rebel. Now, that's page one. So then you go to the next page. Okay, so page two, the Dooline newsletter. The Dooline letter, as a distant early warning system, is entirely concerned with causes that anticipate effects. The miniskirters, living in a global theater programmed as an electric circus, manifest exactly the same attitudes toward education as those which dominate the restructuring of our commercial and political worlds. It does concern the director of an early warning system whether the warning signals will be of any avail. Is there any evidence that men have ever wished to avoid foreseeable catastrophes? Copyright, 1968, Marshall McLuhan. And then, since this is presented in the form of a newspaper, you have this sort of column-like editorials. So here's the editorial. The miniskirt and the mini-planners. Pattern recognition and understanding depend upon awareness of the resonant intervals rather than the visual connections between these new kinds of structures. In this regard, the world of the interval and of resonance, such as our scientists now present as a structure of matter in quotes, offers more help than do all the points of view of the journalists and the sociologists. A point of view is not a probe. A point of view is not a probe, but it offers a facet center from a static one-degree stance. Then he has in big letters, is there some way of getting the consent of adult groups to study the underlying causes in italics, of their conflicts, instead of being totally concerned with the effects of these causes? Then McLuhan says, the great pioneer economist, Harold Innes, built his fame on his study of the cod fisheries and the fur trade. These books are minutely documented accounts of the organization of human enterprise. The later Innes turned in the bias of communication to a study of the different managerial structures that resulted from the use of different technologies. For example, writing on stone and clay created stationary temple bureaucracies, in brackets Babylonian, whereas writing on paper created mobile military bureaucracies with careers open to talents, in brackets Rome. The temple bureaucracies were concerned with the control of time, and the military bureaucracies were concerned with the control of space. These simple factual observations baffled and alienated the colleagues and students of Harold Innes. As soon as he abandoned simply narrative reporting of sequential changes in the economy and tackled the problem of causation in our age of electric discontinuity, he was regarded as, quote, some sort of mystagogue, unquote. At the present time, we have all heard narrative accounts of events of the Apollo 8 project, and we have been told about new sights being set on more distant goals. Who has asked what would be the effect of putting a man-made environment around the moon and the Earth? Peter Drucker points to the present need for a world economy. Then the next part of the editorial is called World Economy. Who is going, in big letters, who is going to put up with the effects of a world economy? Then in small print, the optimum needs of such an economic structure might mean a concept change in the agricultural and manufacturing activities of many parts of the world. At present, it is the spin of the Earth that arranges the conglomerate of weather components. As a new rim of satellites is placed around the Earth, it becomes possible to have global weather controls on the same principle as world economic controls. The best weather for the entire planet on a long-term basis might necessitate turning California into a semi-Arctic climate, or clime. It is this kind of overall patterning of change that results from the instantaneous resonance of a world information environment. When instant information gives simultaneous access of all people to the same world events, to the same knowledge, to the same software wealth, wealth in quotes, the organization structures that result will naturally be the same. Part two of this due line newsletter, number eight, well, no, part two of this due line newsletter number eight, we're doing number seven right now, will be concerned with the restructuring of business and politics under the impact of the new environment of instant information. Then in bigger letters, in next month's issue, this newsletter is in two parts. The first part reports on the disappearance of the old kinds of space and order that had long been associated with habits of visual literacy and privacy. The instantaneous is discontinuous, since when all events are simultaneous, sequence and continuity become meaningless. When sequence disappears, resonance takes over. That is why the new physics conceives of the material universe as structured by resonance. The new space, whether individual, corporate, or global, is a resonant sound light show of discontinuous character.
I have one question, which you just read earlier in the due line. Can you reread what you said about the military? It was a reference to military conquering time, and I believe.
Yeah, temple and military bureaucracies. These are terms from Harold Innes. The later Innes, he puts later in quotes, turned in the bias of communication, that'd be 1951, turned it into a study of the different managerial structures that resulted from the use of different technology. For example, writing on stone and clay created stationary temple bureaucracies, in brackets Babylonian, whereas writing on paper created mobile military bureaucracies with careers open to talents, and Roman brackets. The temple bureaucracies were concerned with the control of time, and the military bureaucracies were concerned with the control of space. Isn't that fine? Fine encapsulations.
Yes. And that's Innes, though. That wasn't McLuhan. McLuhan
yeah,
was just using
Innes
as a quote. Okay.
And that comes from Wyndham Lewis. He's the one who talked about eye versus ear, time versus space. Lewis did a lot of that.
Wow.
Okay, so the next topic, beside the editorial column space, which is on the left of the page two, now you go to the middle of page two, and it's called the high-rise slum. It says, there's a picture of Capitol Records in Los Angeles, that Capitol Records building. It looks like a stack of pancakes. I think that's what this is. It says, the miniskirt can be called instant sex, and that's in quotes. The high-rise apartment has long been recognized as instant slum. So he says, the title of the editorial in this letter concerns the two related environments. Remember, the title was The Miniskirt and the Mini Planners. The title of the editorial in this letter concerns the two related environments, miniskirt, or high-rise clothing, and high-rise buildings, in brackets, which are a form of mini-art. Mini-art is basically a form that depends upon a module or repeatable unit carried to an extreme of sight or sound, like the pancake layers in that Capitol Records building in L.A. It's a module. High-rise living is stripping oneself of neighborhood, as the miniskirt is stripping of attire. As late as 1910, quote, when hoops ran high, that's either quoting Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake, a woman's clothes weighed 14 pounds. That was approximately the weight of canvas on a covered wagon. Clothing and housing were then used as protective shelters for highly civilized private egos. The stripping of clothes from the body and the stripping of neighborhoods from the dwelling. The stripping of clothes from the body and of neighborhoods from the dwelling paradoxically present us with a return to tribal involvement. Pushed to an extreme, the fragmentation of the mini-boxes of the high-rise apartment represents the loss of individual values and goals. The high-rise is like a shell in which the audience does not look or listen, but rather merges. The high-rise is like a shell, think of Wyndham Lewis. The high-rise is like a shell in which the audience does not look or listen, but rather merges. The high-rise tribal slum is not necessarily bad in itself. Rather, its effects are felt as uncomfortable because they destroy all earlier values and goals and privacy. In point of fact, slums, while offering no privacy, can achieve a very high degree of neighborliness. Perhaps it is the difficulty of achieving neighborliness that renders the high-rise so bleak and blear. The high-rise is a vertical suburb. The elevator replaces the roadway. Some estimates indicate that people travel twice as far by elevator as by car today. It is characteristic that the planners, in the pursuit of slum clearance, should create instant slums on a scale never achieved by slums in the past. And I forgot to put you guys on mute.
All participants are now muted.
Then it says, the anger and frustration born in the heart of the high-rise dweller seems to stem from the impossibility of significant involvement in this elegant environment. The dweller feels left out, expendable, a classified item. Where does this continue? Classified item. The dweller feels left out, expendable, a classified item in a directory. He feels as if he were in the white pages rather than the yellow pages in the telephone book. The people in the yellow pages at least have some sort of identifiable role in society. They are listed in accordance with occupation or function. Peter Drucker points to the rise of the mini-state in our world today. Large national entities, which are created by old hardware and mechanical transport, automatically break up into small tribal or regional entities when simultaneous resonance of social interchange is felt around the world. Hence the title of this newsletter. The dynamics of change that dominate the present have nothing to do with one thing following another. The mini-artist, whether in pictures or in sounds, uses a basic module for resonant repetition to create social and personal involvement on a total scale. Okay, I'll unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
Being electronic music there, Roxy. The mini-artist, whether in pictures or in sounds, uses a basic module for resonant repetition to create social and personal involvement on a total scale.
Yes, and maybe also the fact that with the electronic music, there is also the intervals. We're not using like the temperate scales, like the Bach system. You can go into microtonality and polyrhythmics, and these intervals are even reduced because in the Western system, usually the smallest interval is half tone. But with electronic music, you can go to the micro.
Right. McLuhan wrote back in the 50s that the interval was expressed in the golden section geometry. And the interval was itself the interval in Zen Buddhism in the East. So they had two cultural positions. The golden section measured the interval in visual space, and acoustic space had the Zen Buddhist rituals.
It's really interesting because it's like the interval can become the meat. everything can be in the interval.
Yeah.
Everything can be the interval.
Well, McLuhan used to quote Pascal, who quoted an earlier guy, centers everywhere and margins nowhere. So everything's a center, and there's no boundaries or margins to create vertical hierarchies.
Yes, and at the end you said something about involvement? Or
yes. The miniskirt, whether in pictures or in sounds, uses a basic module for resonant repetition to create social and personal involvement on a total scale. When there's the resonant interval, the person runs in to fill in the space, and that creates a community, or a sense of community, or a certain kind of community. Hey?
Yes, I'm still thinking about this last phrase.
Yeah, you must keep it organized, or your mind will break.
When he's talking about high-rises, did high-rises start out with housing, like, housing?
No, high-rises was a development, you know, after World War II. There were the big skyscrapers in the 20s in New York City, and that was maybe helped by the elevator. And then high-rises sort of started in the 1560s, in the wealth of that period, more and more people coming to cities from the country, so they stacked them up in apartment buildings, high apartment rises, which McLuhan calls a vertical slum or a vertical suburb.
I'm looking at your notes, Bob, and you've got topless towers. I rise as mini art, topless towers.
Right. Yeah, we got to get to that eventually. Not right now. But, yep, that's coming down. Exciting return to the greatest McLuhan scholar's notes. We can all look forward to that. Look at the cat scratch on the paper.
There's a wonderful
Bob's memos to himself.
What I like the most about the do lines is like looking at these things from such different angles.
Yeah.
And making all these connections, like the high rise skirt and the high rise buildings and all. It's very interesting how his mind will make these patterns, relating one thing to the other.
Now, here's an important point. He's always conducting seminars, like every Monday night. He might have an exclusive seminar for the open to public intellectuals, or he might just allow anybody to come in. This is where he did his focus group, his espionage. People would react to his ideas and notice things. Oh, look, there's the high rise. And then a joke might come out of it about, you know, vertical slum or something. He was always picking up a lot from his own environment. Very little, in a way, he's an incredibly sounding original writer, but there's a lot of teamwork or taking advantage as a teacher of group situations that he would get some basic new ideas from. And, you know, not saying he's not original, I'm saying he had a whole bunch of new resources to access.
No,
new groups of people.
He was observing others' response to his ideas. And
yes. And letting them make some new jokes.
It's like what they do with Facebook now. This information you are feeding the Android meme.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Used by all types of companies to see, for example, how this population consumes, what they like, what they don't like, and this and that. It's actually like a marketing study that you are feeding for free. It will be so expensive
right.
to to do such a research and the whole
now
globe.
That's an example of personal involvement. The Facebook allows you to communicate and dominate your media profile, but at the same time, you're part of an environment that you're not thinking of that has collective effects, which is agencies can scan the information for patterns. So here you have people, just like in Finney's Wake, they are kings in a certain context and slaves in the other context. McLuhan used to point out that we each of us have about 140 slaves. That means there's a guy at a gas station waiting for you, repair stores, all the different services are your slaves. So you're a king in relation to that, but you are also a slave yourself within all the environments, whatever your job is. You're a slave for a bunch of other kings.
Yes, and in a way you also limit yourself because the Android meme then fits you with what it thinks you might be interested in. For example, if I go to YouTube, I get a series of suggestions according to what I saw last. Or if you Google something, nobody gets the same results. It's according to the information they have from what you are.
Where you come from, like Ion does.
Yeah,
you're
surfing in the internet.
Your pattern of information, your culture, your community, your passion, your story, your narrative, your myth. What is the stage, McLuhan presented? What is the stage in the global theater or in the global membrane? What is the stage? He said the credit card was the stage.
Sure.
And then do we also have, like, different mini stages? Like, we would probably be considered your focus group here on Facebook. That's more of a public arena, so you have a different reaction there. That's a different stage?
Yeah, this is a nano. I updated to nano. This is a nano secret society.
Pico.
Mm. Pico. You know, you've got mini-state was a good concept for the mafia, for the Vatican. The mafia developed sovereign status in 1929. You have the mafias creating mini-states. You have sports leagues having mini-states. The decentralization of the nation, the visually homogenous nation, into multi-level, multi-tiered mini-states. That was a decentralization electric world happened in the 20th century.
So it's like everyone has a stage on which they perform and they get their audience's reactions on.
Right, they generate a stage.
This is the global theater, but now we are going beyond to the
global membrane. You know what it is now? It's millennial ecstatics of five-bodied expression. That's where we live. Millennial ecstatics of five-bodied expression.
Millennial ecstatics.
Are we in the mystery landscape now, or we're coming to? We are, right?
Yeah, we always were, but it's becoming bigger because the previous landscapes have run their course.
Nobody's in control.
Well, you're in control because you can control your own Facebook. You're just not in total control.
Yeah. We all
you're being forced to make a lot of control in your society since the institutions can't serve you well anymore. They're handing the illusion of control over to you, the citizen.